Eoch, Tanuyap, Kwiget Yuans, Kwiens Na. Hi everybody, my name is Kwiget Yuans. I'm a member of the Squamish Nation and the Yogalanis clan of the Haida Nation. You're listening to Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM. We live, work, play, and broadcast from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations.
It's the back-to-school edition of Each for All, and what better way to begin than by listening to young voices singing about cooperation. So here's a huge shout-out to the Grade 5 class at Meadow Lane Public School in Kitchener, Ontario, for their rendition of Corb Lund's Run This Town. And to kids, big and small, educators, parents, bus drivers, support staff, and everyone else making a transition this week, if I speed up and you slow down, all of us together can make lives better for members of our communities. I'm Sandy Goldman, and tonight we'll have our first of the month check-ins with several friends from the cooperative sector. And with me in studio this evening are Ross Gentleman, Chief Economist at CCEC Credit Union and a blogger on credit union matters at cufutures.ca. Welcome, Ross.
Hi there.
And John Kay, President of the Board of Co-ops and Mutuals Canada, Vice Chair of the BC Co-op Association, and CEO of Realize Strategies. Welcome, John.
Thank you, Sandy. Great to be here.
And by phone from Washington, D.C., is Doug O'Brien, President and CEO of the National Cooperative Business Association and Cooperative League of the United States of America. Welcome, Doug. So wonderful to have you with us on Each for All.
Sandy, good to be with you and John and Ross. Hello, everyone.
Excellent. Now, our listeners might remember hearing Doug back in June when he spoke with us from the Co-ops and Mutual Canada Congress in Quebec City. And Doug, now we're ready for a lengthier conversation about co-ops in the United States. And John and Doug, you're going to chime in here too along the way. Doug, you'll be with us for the first half hour this evening, and then we got to let you go to bed because it's after 11 there in D.C. But let's start with some basics here. Can you tell us roughly how many co-ops there are in the United States?
Yeah, the latest numbers we have are from 2018, and we have 65,000 establishments. Now, by that we mean that includes co-ops that have multi-establishments, might be counted more than once. So, you know, that may be about 40,000 individual co-ops and then 65,000 establishments. We've got about 125 million people in the United States that have memberships in co-ops and credit unions, with the vast majority of them with credit unions at about 115 million people. Other sectors in the United States that have gone to scale include the rural electric cooperatives. And here in the United States, they serve about 17% of the households and businesses, about 75% of the geographic part of the United States are served by electric cooperatives in the rural parts. And agriculture, of course, is very strong here in the United States. So credit unions, agriculture, and rural electric cooperatives. But from there, of course, food co-ops, housing co-ops, you know, just like in Canada. We count at least 800,000 direct jobs, and you know, many more than that are reliant on cooperatives here in the United States.
Now, Doug, in Canada, and John, you can correct me if I'm wrong, each of our provinces, and I'm not sure about the territories, have their own provincial co-op associations. Is that correct?
That's right, Sandy.
Do you have that in the does each state have their own state cooperative association to provide support and advocacy?
Some do, but some don't. So there's, I'd say, about 15 of the 50 states have co-op associations, with a number of those, you know, quite strong, particularly in Minnesota and Wisconsin. And then there's a number of other states But many states, in fact, the majority of them, they rely on the National APEX Association, on NCBA CLUSA, to represent them at the federal level. And at the state level, you know, it's not so much an association, but the co-ops that are there, they're kind of on their own.
And so we met the fellow from Minnesota and Wisconsin. He came to Congress last year. What was his name?
Bill Omakin.
Bill Omakin? Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. He was telling us a lot of good stories and all kinds of things. Like, are the Green Bay Packers a co-op?
They are essentially. Oh, yeah, they're community owned. Yeah.
Yeah, that's mm-hmm. great. So in the U.S., what are the can we say, what are the top issues facing co-ops in the United States? We know here a series of surveys over the last few years have said public awareness of the cooperative model. What's going on there in terms of the top issues?
Well, it's a excellent time question for us, because we're in the middle at NCBA CLUSA. We are doing 9 roundtables across the country with regional co-op and community economic development leaders, with the question of really where do we need to prioritize our policy advocacy and policy development. And we're seeing 3 different areas, that are kind of surfacing as themes here. The first is the need for technical assistance to help people put together cooperative businesses. The second one is access to capital. And the third is education and training. And I think that issue that you talked about, public awareness, falls in that bucket. We certainly experience some of the same challenges here. About 5 years ago, we did a survey, we called it the Co-op Trust Survey, queried people, first, kind of 2 basic questions. One, do you know what a co-op is? And we found that about 23% of the people asked had some idea of what a cooperative was. What was really impressive about that survey, though, was for those who that do know what a co-op is, we asked them if they trust that type of business, and 70% of those said that indeed they do trust a co-op, which way outperformed other types of business models. So I think we have some similar challenges across the border.
So how does your organization promote co-ops as drivers of an inclusive economy, and how do you support co-ops in getting off the ground?
Yeah, so we think of our work in kind of 4 in 4 lines. We do advocacy, public awareness, thought leadership, and co-op development. And on public awareness, we have, in fact, it just went out about an hour ago, we do a weekly newsletter, like so many do, but that goes out to the cooperative community and to others interested. We have a cooperative business journal now that we relaunched a couple of years ago that's a quarterly journal. It goes more in depth. They're longer articles, research based, that really dig into some of the key issues that that co-ops are experiencing. And what we're really trying to do, and this is that thought leadership piece, more and more, is we are trying to create the content that's more robust, more research based, that's more compelling to our key audiences. And of course, our key audiences are policymakers and other thought leaders, influencers, and then the general public. So, we have on the advocacy side, we have a co-op caucus in the U.S. Congress, both Democrat and Republican members of Congress who support issues around co-ops. And we have something similar with all the federal agencies called an interagency working group that goes across the federal agencies and tries to identify how different agencies, beyond just, say, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, but how different agencies can support people who are trying to create co-ops.
Given the political climate there and what we observe anyway, I mean, the president is his own mad issue there. But in terms of gridlock, that's what we mm-hmm. see. What is that like for you in terms of your advocacy? Are you? I hear that you're working with federal agencies and various mm-hmm. caucuses. Do you mm-hmm. do you make more progress at the state level or at the congressional and Senate level? It's a different government system there. Where are you most effective, do you feel? in terms of advocating for co-ops?
You know, it's interesting. It's and I've been in working basically in federal policy for the last almost 20 years. I've worked in the U.S. Congress and the U.S. Senate and in the U.S. Department of Agriculture and then the White House for the last 2 years of the prior administration. So this is something I've lived and sort of tracked. And it does at one level, it seems that we're in a really kind of unique and almost unprecedented time in terms of the government's work. But actually, in Washington, D.C., things still happen. The funding bills move through. Some of the bills are authorized. They move through. Those that need to be reauthorized. And at one level, Washington, D.C. is Washington, D.C. You know, it's a capital. It's the federal capital, and things continue to happen. For instance, last year in 2018, one of the actually most important pieces of legislation for cooperatives in some time was passed by this Congress and signed by the president. And it had to do with cooperatives' ability to access small business lending programs. And I won't get into the weeds on it, but basically the small business lending programs, they require that individuals guarantee the loans. And of course, for co-ops, the way that they say that is that every member of a co-op must put down a personal guarantee if the co-op wants to, you know, borrow through this federal program. And of course, it just doesn't work. So we were able, along with a broad coalition, to have a law passed that said, you know, that the Small Business Administration, they need to figure out another way to work with co-ops. And of course, now we're in that stage of the agency, you know, we feel hasn't done what Congress asked them to do and what the law asked them to do, but we're working through that regulatory process. So it's a unique time, but there's still a lot of work to get done, and we're making some progress.
That's really excellent. I mean, for us to hear in Canada that you know, because again, we only get bits and pieces, but that's very important and positive to hear. Let me ask you something. I read about something called the Cooperative Development Foundation.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Can you tell us what that is, what its role is? Are they part of your organization or separate?
Yeah,
what do they do
U.S.? We in the U.S., we have, and I think it's similar in Canada, we have nonprofit, you know, business or nonprofit organizations. And NCBA CLUSA is a certain type that focuses on more on advocacy, and then the Cooperative Development Foundation, it focuses on it. In fact, it can't do advocacy, but what it does is focus more on education and training and co-op development. So we work very closely with CDF. And for instance, there's some work that we've done recently on how to measure the impact of cooperatives on the members and on the communities, and we've arrived at a new framework on how people can measure that impact, and we work very closely with CDF on that. It's a great tool and a great partnership for us to be able to serve the cooperative community.
What kinds of co-ops are sort of leading the way there in the U.S.? I know that's a big question, but what are some of the innovative, exciting successes in terms of, you know, co-ops helping to solve problems in their communities that you know, would give you a chance to talk about? We'd love to hear.
Yeah, there's so much going on as there is, and we got to learn, you know, just, it was such an honor and so much fun to be able to be in Quebec City at the National Congress this year. Cooperatives Mutual of Canada was so terrifically gracious and invited the board of NCBA CLUSA to be with them on a number of days in June, and so, you know, we got to see some of that and saw a lot of similarities. I mean, a few things here in the United States, the larger, I'll say, established sectors of credit unions and agriculture, what we're seeing is that the number of co-ops or credit unions is going down, but the market share is holding steady or increasing, and the number of members for credit unions in particular is increasing. You know, so it's about a mature sector that is undergoing some consolidation, and that of course it raises some really important questions for the cooperative community and on how to how to kind of deal with this dynamic of, you know, on one side it's fantastic that we've got co-ops that are getting to scale that have that capital to navigate, you know, the economy today, and you know, navigate the ability to take advantage of information technology, and to be able to be a real stable business for their members. And then, of course, the other side of that is how do we make sure that the members, you know, that are part of these larger and larger co-ops and credit unions still have a real means of participation and control. So it's, you know, I'm sure some similar issues. So we're working through that. But some of the things I think that are really exciting that I've seen are, you know, are arguably the most important commodity today. And I grew up on a farm in Iowa. And, you know, 100 years ago, the most important commodity in the United States was a bushel of corn or a hundredweight of milk or, you know, a pound of pork. 50 years ago, it might have been a ton of steel. And today, that most important commodity that drives this economy in the United States arguably are zeros and ones. It's information. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, as a cooperative community, and I know it's happening in Canada, I've seen it, it's happening here in the United States, we're asking that question, how can we bring the cooperative principle, how can we bring this unique people-centered business model, you know, to this new commodity of information to make sure that those businesses that are reaping value from this new commodity, reaping value from the information that I give, you know, to Google and to Amazon and, you know, to other people if I get online, how can we make sure that you know, that there's more and more that of these businesses or co-ops? And we've seen some of this. We've seen the startup side. So I'll just give two and then I'll stop talking. We have there's a group called Start.coop that's an incubator for IT and startup co-ops that basically has taken the best of the, you know, kind of an incubator culture for IT, but making sure that it fits the co-op culture and the co-op model. So that's on the startup side. On the established side, we've seen one of the major co-ops based here in the United States and certainly does business in Canada too, Land O'Lakes. They have a program where they're using their resources to use the data that's coming from production agriculture, you know, that the farmers, they're reaping just these mountains of data in the yield data, in soil testing, and they're taking that data and creating value and giving it to their farmers so the farmers can make better conservation and better production decisions. And they're doing it because they're a co-op. They're serving their members, and the members are reaping all of that value. So I think there's just a huge potential, and, you know, it's something that's exciting to see.
It's really very exciting when you talk about it, and we'd love to maybe find a way to touch base with those co-ops and learn more about what they're doing. Mm-hmm. What about on in terms of the environment and climate change? Do you see leadership from co-ops in the U.S. in dealing with these issues? Can you just explain a bit what you notice?
Yeah, and I'll say in that same vein, I'll talk about the established cooperative community, and then I'll talk a little bit about some startups. On the established cooperative community, I mentioned that the rural electric cooperatives, it's a unique and such an important story here in the United States that in, you know, 1932, only 10% of the farmer households in the U.S. had access to electricity, while 90% of people in cities in the U.S. had access to electricity. The federal government created a program for the investor-owned utilities to come and get some cheap credit and some technical assistance. And the investor-owned utilities took a pass. They said, no, we have no interest in that. It doesn't pencil out. Well, the farmers in the United States, they knew what a co-op was, and they said, we'll create our own businesses. And so they came together, created their own businesses, and they access those federal programs that created the rural electric co-op system. So within 20 years, 90% of the farmers had access to that electric infrastructure. So now we've got 900 electric co-ops across the United States. They serve, as I mentioned, about 17%, you know, 45 million or so people in the United States. And they are, there's just some great examples of these co-ops leaning forward and utilizing renewable energy, utilizing energy conservation. There's a program that actually allows the rural electric co-ops, basically what they do is they're able to access some resources from the federal government, and they create a fund, and with the fund, they help their members, those people in rural households and rural businesses, update their residences and their businesses so that they use a lot less energy, they have a lot lower energy bill, and then it's financed just through on-bill financing. It's just a huge win-win-win. So we see that there's a co-op, the rural electric co-ops, they have created another co-op. It's called the National Information Solutions Cooperative. And basically it used to be a kind of a payroll, you know, kind of service. And it's evolved into one, you know, just a huge cloud computing software solutions cooperative that's owned by other rural energy cooperative. So that's on the established side. On the emerging side, seen some really exciting things. And you know, usually in cities where people are coming together to create solar co-ops, here in Washington D.C., actually there's a cool example of how people, are basically just kind of circumventing the great big investor-owned utility in this urban area. And coming together and building solar panels and you know, accessing their own electricity. But the only way they're able to do it is if they come together to get some scale. And so that's happening too.
It's very exciting and very, very encouraging. I'm going to turn it over here to John and Ross to see if they have any questions for you. And then I've got one general follow-up question. So, Ross.
Yeah, one thought, just listening to you, Doug. I have a faint recollection of some of those utility co-ops stepping into the world of internet access and broadband access and so on in non-rural or non-urban rural communities. Am I missing something there, or can you tell me a bit more?
No, that's it. It's a really exciting and important dynamic here. So, in the last really 3 years, both at the federal and state level here in the United States, there's been policy evolution to allow the rural electric cooperatives to expand their service to their members beyond just electricity and into broadband. So today there's about 100 of the 900 electric co-ops that are, that are investing in broadband to serve some of the more remote and hard to serve areas in the United States, which of course is number one, it almost goes without saying, without access to that 21st century infrastructure, you're simply not going to be able to participate in the local, regional or national economy, and, you know, much less be able to access medical services, education, et cetera. But number two, I think it's such a fantastic example of how co-ops that, are evolving to serve their members' needs. So that is happening now more and more, and it's a great thing to see, Ross. That's a great question.
So I'm going to pitch in with one supplementary. One of the things that we have seen in Vancouver, at least, and it's kind of spawned some other projects in Canada, is a car co-op, a car share model based on the cooperative
Modo
model. Yep. We call it Modo in Vancouver, but they have spawned some similar offshoots in some of the smaller communities around British Columbia. I'm not aware of too much in the States, so I'm just priming here. Are there things going on in the States that we might learn from?
Well, the one that I think holds some of the greatest potential has to do with home care and worker-owned home care cooperatives. It's something
growing field.
Field by some measures. You know, in the United States, at least, it's going to be the fastest growing sector of the labor economy, with the what we call the silver tsunami, the baby boomers that are moving into their retirement age, and sort of this, a huge a lot of different factors that are coming into play that suggest that this can really work, because there's already a shortage of people and people's desire to work from home. So we've seen, we'd call it preliminary data that people that work within a home care business, which they own, that's a worker-owned co-op, that the patients, the people that they serve, their clients, they end up with better health outcomes. And the reason is, there's a lot of reasons probably, but one of the reasons is that there's a lot less turnover at the worker co-op.
Right, more buy-in.
Yeah, there's a lot more buy-in. With less turnover, that's the biggest factor in determining the health outcomes, with the patient. So I think there's some really big opportunities there. And so that's one example that really jumped to mind. That same kind of thing comes into play on childcare, which there's in some places, particularly in rural America, there's a real issue on access to quality childcare. So we're looking at how that might work too.
Oh, those are great. John, do you have a question for Doug?
Yeah, I do, Doug. I think many of us in the co-op sector in Canada will often look at the U.S. and particularly jurisdictions like Wisconsin and Minnesota, mm-hmm. some of your large cooperatives like the Farm Credit System or some of your healthcare mm-hmm. cooperatives, and just automatically assume that you're so much further ahead than us. But I'm curious on your perspective, where you see the similarities and the differences in the state of the co-op sector in Canada and the United States.
Well, that's a great question. It might not sound like I'm from the United States, but I don't think we're particularly ahead of where Canada is. I've been watching, Canada. I've been kind of part of the cooperative community for some time. And then we had an opportunity to do a deep dive here this past June. It seems to me that Canada is embracing innovation, just as much as quickly as we are. I think that, we're a bigger country. Our sectors are bigger. We have more people. And when you really look at kind of that correlation on the numbers, we have, I think, similar impacts into each of our economies. I think what Canada has done with your Indigenous communities in terms of utilizing the cooperative business model, we have things to learn here in the United States. And in fact, I was in Billings, Montana, just 6 days ago, in a conversation with some of the leaders in that region about that particular issue. So that's heartening to see. The work done over in Vancouver, I want to spend more time on that side. I've now mm-hmm. been able to see some of the things in the eastern part of the country, but I've certainly read about some of that innovative work. So we've got a lot to learn there too. I think where in the United States, and you, Sandy, you mentioned it, we've really embraced, the NCB Inclus has embraced this idea that co-ops are a strategy to build a more inclusive economy. More and more people are interested in building a more inclusive economy that's more participatory, more equitable, more stable, more sustainable, and grows for everyone. But a lot of people down here, they don't think of co-ops as a proven preferred strategy, and that's what we're really trying to do. And I think, in parts of Canada, that's one thing I've found, I found interesting too, is how the penetration in different geographies of Canada is, can really vary. And that's similar here too.
It's so interesting. We have sort of a North American perspective here. And my last question to you is, are there opportunities or is there a cooperation between Co-ops and Mutuals Canada and your national organization there? Doug, are you guys putting heads together? I know John's coming down to your co-op impact conference,
yeah.
and your team spent time here at in Quebec
yeah.
City. Is there something going on, and are there things we can learn from each other? Is that ongoing cooperation among co-ops going on in terms of Canada and the U.S. and I don't even know about Mexico there, a North American perspective? I'm just wondering.
Yeah, well, I mean, we got to put this sixth principle to work, right? Or we need to work at the sixth principle. And there's a lot of potential. I think the Canadian and U.S. cooperative communities over the years and the decades have certainly, had exchange, had relationships that have, I'm sure have kind of waxed and waned. But I think we're in a place right now where we are just really interested. And, more and more, and I don't, to my knowledge, CMC hasn't done this. We certainly haven't done it. And to be inclusive, there's more and more the cooperatives that are in our membership, they're doing business across the border. So it's in our membership's interest, but at the end of the day, it is absolutely in our interest to think about how, just again, some of this basic stuff of how to advocate, mm-hmm. how to increase public awareness, and then probably, some of these questions around capital access, which has been continually sort of vexing kind of questions, but in the economy we find ourselves in now. And I see some of the things that you're doing in terms of CMC and others are doing in terms of, an investment fund. I read about, Andre Baudry, since he and I were in communication just last week about the great success that you had with the fund for emerging entrepreneurs. And
yes, we're going to talk about that, the future entrepreneur program. Right, a lot of advocacy got that off the ground for young cooperators.
There's a lot of those things that we need to bring, those ideas, to stoke those ideas. And there's so many things in common that we have, both culturally, economically, that I'm looking forward to really growing that relationship. And I think it's going to serve the members of the co-ops on both sides of the border.
That's wonderful. It's very exciting. We want to thank you so much for spending some time with us this evening. And we hope that you'll come back and be a guest again on Each for All, the Cooperative Connection. Doug, thanks so much. That was Doug O'Brien, President and CEO of the National Cooperative Business Association, speaking with us tonight from Washington, D.C. Are you going to turn in now? Or are you too excited after our discussion?
Well, I'm pretty excited, but I have an early meeting.
Okay.
If I get there. But hey, John, I really look forward to seeing you here in just a few months, and hopefully some more of your colleagues from Canada. It was great to be with you in June, and see you soon.
Yeah, likewise, Doug. Really looking forward to it, and be happy to have you come back to Vancouver and spend some time here learning about our co-op sector.
We'll do it.
Okay. Great. All right. Thanks so much. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Thanks to my colleague Dale McGladdery for his help with tonight's program from the studios of Vancouver Co-op Radio, 100.5 FM and online at cooperadio.org. And for podcasts, news, and events, check out our website, eachforall.coop. I'm Sandy Goldman, wishing everyone a cooperative week and a fantastic and fulfilling school year ahead. Thanks for listening.
Your everlasting summer, you can see it fading fast. So you grab a piece of something that you think is gonna last. Well, you wouldn't even know a diamond if you held it in your hand. The things you think are precious, I can't understand. Are you reeling in the